Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ferns predate the dinosaurs. They have survived for hundreds of millions of years. The odds are also good that they can survive and thrive in your yard. Ed Lyon is here today to introduce us to the wonderful world of ferns. He is director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, which is an underwriter of IPR. Hello, Ed.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And ferns are truly incredible plants. They are ancient, right?
That's true. In fact, we call them pre-vascular plants. They hadn't even developed some of the systems within themselves to transport the minerals up and water up and food down like the rest of our plants. So they had to rely very heavily on sort of moist conditions, but many of them have adapted past that as well.
How many varieties of ferns are there?
Oh, geez. there's one of my favorite books is the Encyclopedia of Ferns, and it's pretty thick. So a wide number of species. And then there's a certain number of species that have a large number of cultivars, which, of course, our homeowners tend to, you know, look for that kind of variation within a species.
Well, and you mentioned moisture. Moisture is really important to ferns, and we do think about them growing in really moist environments. Iowa is not the moistest of environments.
That is true.
What kinds of varieties can grow here?
Well, probably the single largest species that you'll see people use is the Aetherium, which that's our lady ferns. And that would include things like our common lady fern, which is a native plant, but also the Japanese lady fern. In fact, you'll often hear it called painted fern because one cultivar of that was the painted Japanese lady fern. And then there's been many since, and that one's been very common. The second most common group are probably the Dryopteris, and they're the wood ferns, and they're huge as far as selection availability. But we have a large number of native ferns as well. We have our sensitive fern, our royal fern, cinnamon fern. They're all native plants, and to some degree probably are fairly familiar names to the public.
So in thinking about where ferns grow well in the environment that we have in Iowa, what is ideal?
Shade.
All right.
Ideal all the time with people that shade is an issue. It always seems to be a bigger issue than sun. Most people figure out how to grow plants in sun, but a lot of our questions come with shade gardening, and they're a great friend to the shade gardener, not just what they add to it as plants themselves, but from a design perspective as well. I tell everybody when you're designing, you want to look at contrasting your textures and your forms. What I used right to start when I'm building a garden is two plants, hostas and ferns, and there's others that fit. But they're the two really biggest differentiations in contrast. So you got the big, bold foliage of hosta. You put the fine foliage of a fern next to it. You've already got that contrast. You've already got that visual interest. So just a combination of those two plants together. So they just fit so well into a lot of the design work that we do. And there aren't a lot of plants out there with that sort of fine lacy texture. So they're just great for that.
When you plant ferns in a garden, do they behave well? Do they stay put where you want them to be?
All but three. and even then, I think many, many people, especially if they've had it or they do have it, will recognize ostrich fern. And I actually like the fern. It is tall. It'll get at least waist high, and beautiful form. It sort of comes up from we call it an ascending form. It comes up and almost looks vase-shaped. The problem is it will run. There's just no way around it. That very tall fern that you see around a lot of people's houses that just masses so thickly, that's ostrich fern. And one of the other issues is if it gets hot afternoon sun in the summer and it gets dry, it'll burn up and it doesn't look very nice at all. It'll recover from it, but it sure doesn't look good. There are also two other ferns that you don't see commonly sold, bracken fern and hay-scented fern, that are natives. They are also two that if you happen to put in a garden setting will probably run rampant and you'll regret doing it. But in the same regard, as I was saying with the ostrich fern, there are areas, particularly like on the north side of a house, where you simply want a nice ground cover. You know, we're always struggling with what's a good ground cover. And a ground cover doesn't have to be right low to the ground. It simply means it covers the ground and helps keep weeds out. And boy, ostrich fern will do that for you if you're just looking for a big, bold plant that will cover ground and you're not worried about it competing with other plants.
Well, speaking of competition, I was reading about ferns yesterday and I saw a recommendation that, you know, you can grow it in sort of a wooded area and it will give the opportunity to have those spring wildflowers before the ferns come in. Do they interact well with plants that way?
They do. In fact, ferns are some of the last things to really start showing their growth in my garden. And all of my spring bulbs have already come out. In fact, they're probably in decline by the time that the ferns start coming up. And, you know, there's variations in the different species. But overall, they kind of sit there and wait a little bit. And, so they work very well for that, especially some of the very fine foliage forms, because, again, then they're not these great big robust plants that are trying to compete with plants not quite as large and robust.
Every week on this show, we talk about some of the pests and diseases that plague plants. How about ferns with pests and diseases?
Hey, that's one of the good points. I don't know of any. you know, it's mostly cultural with ferns. You know, the temperatures, certainly moisture content. Most of them are fairly adaptable to soils. That's not even really a big issue. But I really don't know of any pests and diseases. I simply don't have them in my own garden, and it's just not a big thing.
So we talked about how if they get too much sun, they can kind of burn up and shrivel up. What about water? If we have a really dry year, will they kind of disappear?
They can, yes. And they're doing that to protect themselves. And if it's a gradual sort of movement into dormancy, because that's what they're doing, they're going to protect themselves and go dormant, then they should be fine. And when watered again, you know, you should start to see the growth. I don't really want them to get to that point. I certainly don't want a chance actually killing them. And certainly if you go through a really hot, dry streak and they dry up very, very quickly, then you know that they could very well be dying. They don't have the time to actually go into dormancy. You're actually killing them at that point. But the rhizoma, they don't have true roots. They have rhizomes. They're sort of waxy, and they're actually pretty adapted to conserving moisture, which then helps them, too, if they go into a dormancy. I would probably make the analogy to, like, your bleeding hearts. If you keep bleeding hearts watered all season long, they don't go dormant. It's that heat and sunlight that puts them into a dormancy. And the same thing with the fern. And some of them will and some of them won't. Probably the most sun-adapted ones that we're using right now are the Japanese painted ferns. They use them a lot as ground cover in the south, and they do tend to be a little more of that sun and heat tolerant than some of our woodland ferns.
In the wild, ferns reproduce by spores. If you want to propagate them in your yard, what method should you use?
Well, it's actually not that difficult to do them by spores. And if you did a Google search, some people that love growing things from seeds, they would probably love the challenge of trying ferns from spores as well. But the average homeowner certainly isn't going to do that. It'll take a long time to get a garden fern. Ferns are easy to divide, so that's generally the way that you would get more out of your own garden. And it depends on the species. Some of them will multiply fairly rapidly, and others you might have in the ground 3-4 years and really not get a clump big enough that you'd actually would want to divide. So it depends on the species.
Ed, I'm not hearing very many downsides to planting ferns. This seems like a pretty good plan.
I think the biggest challenge, and because when I get into any plant, I've got to have every one of them, the availability. I think the biggest challenge for ferns is simply that most of your garden centers only carry a very limited number of species and cultivars. It's kind of weird. I've noticed within like the last 10 years, almost all the ferns I'm buying, I buy mail order. Mm. Because if I really want that selection, if I really want some of these, because ferns will, the word's not coming right now, change genetically. You'll get mutate easily. And we get all these really kind of cool forms out of them, and different types of fronds and crested fronds and colored fronds. But you just can't find that kind of availability unless you go mail order.
All right. Ed Lyon is director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. For more gardening information and tips, please subscribe to our Garden Variety newsletter. Find out more at iowapublicradio.org/garden. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Ed Lyon is here today, director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, which is an underwriter of IPR. Aaron Stile is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you both so much for being here today. And of course, we can talk ferns and we can talk all kinds of plants, but we do have a lot of questions already. So let's start with this question from Anne Marie. She says, I'm caught in the midst of conflicting information about mulch. For years, I have put shredded cedar mulch in my flower beds, hostas and blueberries, for water retention and weed control. However, I keep getting warned that mulch is a primary source of pests, such as carpenter ants. They live in decomposing wood. I have had carpenter ants in my house twice, so it could happen again. Advice?
So carpenter ants live in masses of decomposing wood, logs and stumps, not shredded bark. Now, it still is a great environment for them to hang out in, but they're not building their nest in shredded bark. They're building their nest in a mass of something, whether that's a stump or a log or, unfortunately, your home. But if you're there are quite a few different insects that really enjoy that kind of moist and cool environment of mulch, and by and large, almost all of them are pretty innocuous for our homes and for our gardens. If you're having trouble with carpenter ants, chances are that even if you remove the mulch, you would still have carpenter ants. So it's easy to blame mulch for something like that. And it can be a great place for insects to hang out, but they're living in a different type of decomposing wood, not the shredded up tiny pieces of mulch.
All right. So the carpenter ants are not your fault, and you can keep mulching, Anne-Marie. that's the takeaway, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you probably would have carpenter ants even without mulch, because other types of mulch are just as damp and potentially inviting to them as well, especially in the shade.
All right. Next question from Bruce. Is there a way to eliminate what appears to be powdery mildew on my nine bark? The plant was covered last year, and so late in the fall, I pruned it back quite heavily. This spring, it looked really nice, but I'm now seeing signs of it returning. Is there anything that can be done to eliminate this?
I don't know that you would completely eliminate it. Certainly fungicides, that's what they're made for, something like powdery mildew, but keep in mind fungicides are more preventative than they're curative. So the recommendation is then to start spraying every 7 to 10 days or so with the fungicide. I just don't find powdery mildew. I mean, visually it's not the prettiest thing, but I don't get overly alarmed when I get it either. If we start getting, and we haven't seen rain in quite some time, I'm watering like crazy at home myself right now. It can clear up as well if we get into sort of hotter, drier environment. So it all just depends on how much you want to embrace using something like a fungicide. It's not harmful to the environment. But again, you're going to have to do it every 7 to 10 days. And it's already started, so you're not going to completely eliminate it by using the fungicide.
The number to call with your question, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's go to the phones. Kathy's on the line in Ruthven. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, we have 4 endless summer hydrangeas that were planted new last year. They all did well. They are in a partially shaded area. But the spring, they're doing nothing. They look like they're dead. I don't know what happened to them. They were cared for well. Am I expecting too much? Is it too early or what?
Are they not showing any growth whatsoever?
No, they're not.
That's not a good sign. By now,
no.
I have a number of macrophylla hydrangeas, which Endless Summer is. They've all thrown up some shoots, at least. So I would say it's very likely. And you can start to just dig a little bit around the plant. And if all of it's just sort of falling apart and not holding together, that's a pretty good sign. You know, it's going to rot if it's dead.
They do seem like they're holding together, but there's just no green showing at all.
You know, it's not a good sign. I mean, certainly don't dig them up right away. Give them some time. It's not really most of our favorite hydrangea to begin with. In fact, in the industry, we kind of jokingly call it Endless Bummer. The plant has an issue in that over time it quits flowering. You'll get fewer and fewer flowers every year. It wasn't one that it's done wonders in other areas of the country, but it's not one that does particularly well in the Midwest. In fact, most of the big leaf hydrangeas don't. They like acidic soils. They like the East Coast. They don't do as well for us out here.
Okay. Well, we were upping the soil for the acid, doing everything we thought we should do, but they didn't come back this spring.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's very, very difficult for us in the alkaline areas of the country. You can put on all of these recommendations of making your soil more acidic. It'll never happen. Our rainwater, the water we water with, our soils, everything about the Midwest keeps the conditions alkaline. And so they like to lead you to believe that somehow you'll be able to get your soil pH down, and there's no way that we can do it and have it stay low pH like the East Coast.
The pictures on the tags on the hydrangeas are really misleading for what they can do here in the Midwest. And Kathy, I'm so sorry. It sounds like, though, you got disappointed a little earlier than many people who buy the Endless Summer, but disappointment may have been coming anyway. And it's funny, Ed, because I see it for sale everywhere.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. It just hasn't performed well. And it's either the first or second most sold plant in history, along with Knockout Rose. And I have a funny little story. I was actually at a conference that Michael Durr was at. And I think many people know who Michael Durr is. I made the comment, we were talking about the plant, and I called it Endless Bummer. And afterwards, I got thinking, oh my God, that man developed that hydrangea.
No.
So I ran quickly to the bar where he was having a drink to apologize. And he says, oh, don't apologize. He says, this concept that one plant could do equally well all across the country is ridiculous. There is no one plant will ever develop that can do that. So it's not that it's not a good hydrangea. It's just that it's not a good performer for us. And that's why I brought it up, because my recommendation is if they are dead, then I wouldn't go back and put in another Endless Summer. I'd probably look at something else.
If you have a question, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got a couple lines open for you right now. Again, 866-780-9100. With me today, Ed Lyon, director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. Sarah in Des Moines has this question. I've heard that you should not plant hot peppers near sweet bell peppers. Is it true? And if so, how far away from each other should the two groupings be planted?
The genetics of the plant are set by the plant itself. So the fruit's going to develop the same kind of fruit no matter what it cross-pollinates with. The challenge will be is if you save the seed, then that might be a little bit different. But we often hear this that, oh, hot peppers or sweet peppers are hotter when they're planted next to hot peppers. And most of the time, if the sweet pepper has a different flavor to it, it's because of the growing conditions. It's really dry, it's really hot, something like that. It is not because it cross-pollinated with a neighboring hot pepper. That fruit that develops will be genetically, the genetics of that fruit come from the plant itself. The seed inside of it might be different because of the cross-pollinating, if it cross-pollinated, but the fruit itself will always be the same. So if you're seeing a difference in taste, it's because of the environment, not because of the cross-pollination.
All right. She also wants to know about the recommendation for planting cucumbers near tomatoes.
No problem.
Excellent. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Dennis is on the line in Decorah. This may be a question that is outside of both of your area of expertise, but let's give it a try. Hello, Dennis. Oops, I didn't put Dennis on the air. Hang on. I went the wrong way. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. The first produce of spring are fiddleheads. Which ferns make the best fiddleheads?
All right. So these are wild edibles. And I know that's not an area of expertise for either one of you, but do either one of you eat fiddleheads?
The most common.
Fiddlehead ferns.
Yeah.
Yeah. The most common that are used are the ostrich fern that I just mentioned. And that's because they produce a good, large size fiddle. Certainly, if you were to use, let's say, maidenhair fern, They're going to be the, like these really little teeny tiny things. As far as if he's also asking about flavor, I've never sampled different ones to say one is more flavorful than the other. But you're going to be looking for the, you know, the larger ferns that are producing a good size crozier or fiddle to begin with. And so that tends to be your ostrich fern, probably sensitives, cinnamon, royal could fit in there, but they're smaller fiddleheads as well. So it's more about the size.
Do you ever eat them, Ed?
I've had them, yes, and they are quite good. My mom, I grew up on a farm in upstate New York. She was very much into eating a lot of, I mean, we ate cattails, we ate ramps. I mean, she was constantly
foraging.
Foraging, yep. And nice. Fiddleheads were one of those.
All right, do you have a favorite method of preparation?
No, she fixed them.
Just however mom actually, made them.
Yeah.
It's kind of a lot like asparagus.
It is. It's fixed pretty much the same way.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Charles is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I've got a question. I'm looking at a couple of different trees that I'd like to plant in my yard. One of them is the Kentucky coffee tree, and the other one is a northern catalpa. The northern catalpa has a little bit of history for me. I grew up with one in my backyard. I spent a good part of my youth climbing that tree, but I just wanted your guys' opinion on if there was any advantage of one over the other.
Yeah, you know, I will start with the catalpa. I feel like this tree is a little polarizing for some people because it is a beautiful tree, native, and has the most wonderful, almost orchid-like flowers in early summer. But it also can be viewed in a different lens as one of the messiest trees you could plant in your yard. It gets those flowers when they drop are quite messy. It tends to not have the greatest fall color, and then those big leaves kind of fall off, and it gets these big, long, bean-like pods that aren't beans, actually. They're full of little fluff seeds that can very easily reseed in different areas if you're not careful. So you kind of have to balance which one of those you like. I could almost say the same thing about oaks, too. Oaks are some of the messiest trees in our gardens, too, but they're lovely trees for other reasons, and you could probably make a similar argument to catalpa that way. The challenge is that you often don't see it in nurseries because it is a little more difficult to transplant. It doesn't transplant as readily as like a maple or an oak or an elm. And so often finding it and buying it smaller is usually more successful for folks if they are trying to plant one. Kentucky coffee tree is a wonderful tree, especially the seedless varieties or the male selections. They usually have cute cultivar names like Espresso, they don't get the big kind of thick, leathery seed pods on them, although they're not, that can be a little annoying. The trees aren't covered in these big pods, and they're certainly manageable even if you have a tree that gets them. But Kentucky coffee tree is actually probably one of the most recommended ash replacement trees we have that we give out for Iowa landscapes. So that's a good tree, too.
Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Next up, let's go to Karen in Carlisle. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a question about a patch of ground in my yard that I have trouble growing any plants in. It's an area that's about 12 feet by 4 feet wide, and it's shaded in the morning, and it's sunny in the afternoon. My problem is I think the soil is not the best. It's an old alley that years ago people probably dumped ashes and garbage and probably anything into it. And I tried planting hostas there and they didn't do well at all. So I wonder if there's anything I could plant there that would do well. I'd prefer a perennial if I could.
Ooh, tough plants. So one of the things I would recommend is even while you're thinking about what you might try there, is to try to work in some organic matter into this area. Even if all you're doing is layering it on top like mulch, and not even taking the time to like dig it in with a fork or a spade into the top couple of inches, introducing some of that organic matter, since it sounds like the soil is a little rough, will help any plant that you potentially could plant there. One of the questions I have is it well contained? Like if we recommended something that's pretty vigorous in its spread, would it get everywhere, or are there like driveways and buildings and stuff around it that could contain something?
No, it's actually it's in front of the neighbor's white fence, and I've got little boulder rocks around it, separating it from the yard and from anything else. And there's nothing really around it other than that.
Because the first thing that comes to mind are some of the vigorous ground covers, but if you're not careful, they can be a curse. but things that would tolerate more sun, like vinca vine, would potentially work there. But if you're not careful, that one can get out and you could be really, you know, disappointed in where it might travel to. But kind of the other one that comes to mind are daylilies that are pretty tough plants. I would probably lean away from the quote unquote ditch daylily, which is that orange one that you see that runs through the ditches. But just about any other cultivar or named cultivar of daylily would probably tolerate that location fairly well.
Karen, good luck with that. We're going to take a short break, and you can join the conversation. Call with your questions, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Ed Lyon, Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Ed Lyon, Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, which is an underwriter of IPR. Aaron Stile is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and you can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jerry is up next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes. I'm trying to take good care of the trees I planted here in Cedar Rapids after the derecho, and I have some trees that are about 15 or 20 feet tall, and my question is about pruning them. Is now too late to prune them? Should I wait until winter or next spring? And do I continue to prune as far as I can reach to make sure that the tree maintains a strong leader?
Okay, so it would be, I'll talk first about timing. Ideally, we prune in the late dormant season. Now, if you have a branch that's like whapping you in the face every day or every time you're trying to get around that plant, you could prune that out now. There's been some more research that more recently has been done that kind of shows that even spring and early summer pruning recovers pretty well and isn't very stressful on trees. So you could do that. But we still really recommend the ideal time if you can wait to do it in the late dormant season. So that's like the month of March for us. And so in terms of timing, that's what I would aim for. In terms of pruning up, ideally, when you step back from that tree, at least 2/3 of the height has branches on it. And more would be better. So as you can prune up, we would recommend that you can prune up as high as 1/3 of the total height of the plant. But the longer you leave those lower branches on, the more it helps that trunk develop good, kind of what they call taper, and get nice good diameter on it, because those branches are there helping to feed and helping to grow that part of the tree. So resist the urge to prune up too far too quickly. And anytime you can keep it for as long as you can keep it with a strong central leader, the better it will be. Some trees really fight you on that. Elms and maples are notoriously hard to keep like one strong central leader. Eventually, it will kind of split into more branches, and that's fine. The higher up that you can make that happen, often the better the structure for the tree.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. Next up, Bob in Carlisle. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Wanted to give you some good news on plants. I found a really good wisteria. Been doing really well for me the last few years. It's called Amethyst Falls. There must be at least 50 to 60 blooms in each of the two plants I have. And they are beautiful, unbelievably beautiful. Oh. And it blooms more than once a year.
Congratulations, Bob. That sounds great.
Yeah, amethyst, that's been a nice cultivar for the Midwest in particular. I see it quite frequently around. So that's good to hear that it works well for you too, Bob.
Absolutely. Are there other wisterias that grow well here?
Ant D. We have Ant D at Ryman Gardens, and it covers the trellises and coming into bloom now. I have amethyst that falls at home, and it's in bloom. The one thing I will say to folks, though, is make sure whatever you're using to support that is very rugged. I don't think people have any idea to what size that a wisteria will eventually get. I was fortunate once to be visiting a friend in France, and he showed me, he was 71 at the time, and showed me a wisteria his mother had planted when he was born. And the trunk on that thing was bigger around than my trunk. But they do. They get very woody. Over time, they grow faster. They start a little bit slower and grow faster. And you want to make sure that whatever you have support, it'll tear down trellises. You want it on a very good support system.
Well, and of course, that's what you want, is for it to get giant and look amazing and be really spectacular, right?
Yep.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Next up, Diane in Algona. Hello, Diane.
Yes, I've been trying to grow hellebores in my garden for several years, and I've moved them and tried them in different places, and they always die on me. What am I doing wrong?
That's a good question, because hellebores are not that difficult.
No, not typically. What are the growing conditions like? Would you say shade, sun, wet, dry? How would you describe it?
The places I've tried them have been shade, sun, wet, dry. I tried them all over my yard. I have a lot of mature oaks, and I've got plantings, garden beds based around the oak trees, and I've tried them in there, and I've tried them in my sunnier gardens, and I just don't seem to have any luck.
Yeah, so my first inclination is that, most shade plants really don't love dry conditions. There are some that tolerate dry conditions better, like hosta, like barren wort or epimedium, but even those plants would much prefer to have more moisture. And the roots of a large tree really take a lot of that away. And so it can be a really challenging spot, especially in the first couple of years. So hellebores do fine in more dryish situations. In fact, I think I've even seen them sometimes on dry shade lists, but you still have to get them established first. And so I'm wondering if, a good part shade location, regular watering the first several years to help get them really nicely established would probably make a big difference. And then once they're there and once they're nicely established, they are pretty tough plants. But I'm kind of wondering if there's just been so much moving around that they've just never been able to get fully established and perform well.
Diane, good luck. That sounds very, very frustrating. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Margaret's on the line in Indianola with a question about dryness. It has been dry. Margaret, what do you want to talk about?
Well, we have a number of large trees in our yard, and we lost quite a few during the last, there was a drought, 10, 15 years ago? And so I'm really nervous about trying to save our trees. We talked with our tree guys, and they suggested using those hoses that have holes in them, and they're supposed to be able to sprinkle out, but I don't know, those hoses didn't work. So just wondering if you had any good ideas.
So how big is the diameter of the trunk on these trees, would you say?
Some of them are large trees. I mean, they've been here like 50 years.
Okay. So the reason why I ask most established trees will not need supplemental water, even in pretty dry situations. And the hardest part about watering a more established tree, or even one that's been in the landscape for 10 years and say is 5-6 inches in diameter or even larger depending on the species, is providing water to where the roots actually are. When we first plant a tree, they're pretty confined to a relatively small space. But once that tree gets larger and the spread on it gets to be more like 25-30 feet, the roots are spread that wide too, which is probably why the tree professional had recommended using like a soaker hose or a sprinkler, I'll call it a sprinkler hose. It's like a hose with a bunch of little holes in it that looks more like a sprinkler when it's operating, because you have to wet that entire root area, which can be pretty hard to do. The other thing you could do is just set up a classic oscillating sprinkler underneath the tree if you're really concerned about it. But check the soil moisture first. Make sure that it is indeed dry in the first couple of inches of soil, and then set up an oscillating sprinkler if you're having trouble with those kind of holy hoses.
The other issue with those types of hoses is, if you think about it, they're going to put out a lot of the most water right immediately around where those holes are. And the farther you get away from that, the less and less water you get. So if you really want even moisture, you've got to be crisscrossing these things fairly close mm-hmm. together. And that's an expense, and just the fact, you know, how do you install them? So they're not disrupting other maintenance issues. And like Aaron said, you know, put out an overhead sprinkler. Just keep in mind, it takes a fairly long time. A lot of people think, oh, I put it out for an hour and so I've soaked the ground good. And it generally takes longer than that. What I do is I try to water over a number of days. And that way it starts to soak in more. But simply putting one out for an hour one day probably isn't doing a lot of good.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Melissa's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your question?
Oh, hey, I thank you so much for taking my call. I planted a very tiny Eastern Star magnolia last year, probably in April or May. It's only about 14 to 16 inches tall, and I'd like to move it about 10 to 12 feet, and I'm wondering what you can recommend for the process and if it's too late in the year to do it right now.
I would probably avoid moving it at this point. We're going into the really tough part of year. In just a few weeks, it's going to be hot and dry for most of the garden, and that's a really hard conditions for a newly transplanted or newly planted any plant to go into. The ideal time to move a small tree like this is late dormant season. So before it's leafed out, but after the ground has thawed or is no longer frozen. So if you can wait until then, that would be the best time. You're going to try to get as large of a root ball as you can handle. And you'll want to, if possible, move it directly to its new location. If that's not possible, the shortest amount of time in a container is what you're going to aim for. Get it into its new spot with the largest root ball that you can manage right away in the late dormant season. That's the ideal situation.
Melissa, thanks for the call. And the email questions have been piling up, so we'll try to get through a bunch of these. All right. Cindy says, I have a large bed of established perennials and grasses in its fifth year, and I'm wondering how often I need to water it.
I would say only if conditions are super dry. By year five, perennial borders are well established. And so if we go into a drought situation, you may want to provide some supplemental irrigation. But otherwise, it should be good on its own.
It has been dry. Are you starting to feel nervous, Aaron?
You know, a lot of the stuff that I've newly planted, our annuals, my vegetable garden, I certainly have been watering, but I'm not nervous about my perennials yet.
All right. Jim and Colo says, last Friday, we planted a semi-dwarf fireside apple tree that's about 8 feet tall. The tree has around 24 small apples on it. Should we clip these apples off to allow the energy to go to growth of vegetation and roots?
You know, they'll probably fall off on their own this some early in the summer, but if they don't, it might be beneficial, especially if it's so newly planted, to let it focus more on root development and growth than to try to get, you know, a few knobby little apples the first couple of years. Ideally, we see apples in full fruit about 5 to 6 years after planting. So year one and two, usually no fruit. If and 3 and 4, you might have tiny little crops. But then by year 5 or 6, you should expect a kind of a quote-unquote full crop.
All right. And he wants to know if he should cut the stems or pull the stem from the branch.
I would just remove the tiny little apple if you want to remove it. So with the scissors, you know, just the little spot that it attaches to, don't cut off any of the branch tips or branches.
All right. From Susan in Iowa City, I planted some vegetable plants in our south-facing raised beds almost 3 weeks ago. Since that time, we have not had any appreciable rain. There's no rain predicted in our area for another 7 to 10 days. How often should I be watering these vegetable plants, tomatoes, peppers, squash, yeah, cucumbers, herbs, etc.?
Almost all vegetable gardens, even in the nicest of years, require some supplemental irrigation at some point during the year to get good vegetable production. And so, especially if things are dry, you'll want to water regularly. Ideally, you are providing, I mean, that kind of classic 1 inch of water a week, either from you or from Mother Nature. This is where a rain gauge becomes really beneficial. And ideally, you're doing that with deep waterings. And especially in the vegetable garden, you're not getting foliage wet because there are several vegetables, most of the melons, the cucumbers, the tomatoes, they develop really significant disease issues on their foliage that is more easily spread when foliage is wet. So if you can keep the foliage dry while you're watering, all the better.
All right. Mike is bringing us full circle here. Eddie says, is it too late in the season to transplant ferns? My mom has a whole bunch behind her garage and I'd like to dig some up and plant them at my house.
It's not ideal. Again, as Aaron mentioned, we're heading into some of that hotter and harsher conditions, but it can be done. I've highly advise once you've moved them, you're going to want to keep the water to them. You're not going to want them to dry out. Ferns in particular, over a lot of other plants, that will be critical to keeping them moist. And if there's any way, if they're getting any sun at all, you might even want to use maybe some shade cloth or some kind of protection as they reestablish, because again, you're putting them in stress at a time of year that isn't ideal for transplanting. If you can wait, I certainly would, at least until fall.
All right. And Russ asks, what plants would survive or thrive under the low canopy of a Norway spruce? Hostas?
Oh, this would be a tough spot because it's going to be low light and it's going to be very dry because of all the roots from that tree. Hostas, maybe. Especially if you can get them established by doing a little bit of supplemental watering, that especially that first year, maybe even the second year, they're pretty tough plants. And so that would be one I would certainly start with. What other dry shade ideas do you have, Ed?
Epimediums, great.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how much that will tolerate. It depends on how, I mean, spruces should have their branches going to the ground. So it depends on how much you've pruned it up, because mm-hmm. Some people will prune them up considerably.
All right, Ed Lyon, thank you so much. Aaron Style, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Ed Lyon, director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Aaron Style, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News. Our producers are Caitlin Troutman, Samantha McIntosh, and Danny Gear. We had technical support today from Nick Brinks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.